The Dolo White Podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. Follow Cinema Anywhere Nashville on Instagram and book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience today.
Hey, it's Dolo White, and this is the Dolo White Podcast. We've talked about the environment a few times on the podcast, and most of it is some seriously scary shit. However, kind of have an optimistic outlook, an optimistic episode today, somewhat anyway. Now, just because my guest today, Michael Medawebster, the author of The Rescue Effect, is somewhat optimistic about climate change, that does not mean go out and litter and buy a fucking 12-cylinder truck and just drive all around. No, we still have to do our part to make sure the climate change is slow, to make sure the environment is good. But he does kind of have an optimistic outlook, which is a nice breath of fresh air. So let's get it started. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Pull up, Giddy. Live.
Yeah. What's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolo White Podcast.
All right, episode 91 now of the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, author of the new book, The Rescue Effect, Michael Medawebster. Thank you for being here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your book offers a kind of a different approach to the planet. I think most things that we see are, you know, everybody run, it's going to be really bad. And you kind of have an optimistic outlook on the environment, correct?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Listen, there's a lot of doom and gloom in conservation work. And, you know, I've been working in this for a long time. And it's not coming out of nowhere. There is plenty of bad news in the environment. But I think it's also important to step back, you know, every once in a while and acknowledge that there's actually a lot of really good things going on as well.
Is your argument that, I know we'll get into the six different types of rescue effects and all of that, but is your argument basically like evolution, we're going to continue to evolve with the earth? Is that kind of the basis of it? Or
I mean, listen, that's in the ballpark. The basic argument is this, that the earth has always been changing, and organisms that have persisted have gotten pretty good at dealing with changing environments to the point where, you know, when the environment begins to change, there are all these systems, you mentioned there's six of them, that turn on automatically that help organisms and species adapt. I've described this in my book as collectively adding up to what I call the rescue effect, which is a really powerful force in nature. And as we see today, most species are currently adapting to the changes that we are creating on the planet, and it's because of the rescue effect.
Are humans adapting to that?
Sure. Humans are probably the most adaptable species that's ever been present on Earth, which is why we've gotten to such high population sizes and why we've been able to live in almost any corner of the planet.
In what ways, then, are humans... I know that you know this already. There are arguments against, or not, I don't want to say valid arguments against evolution, but there are arguments against evolution. You're saying that we are continuing to evolve right now. How so?
Well, so evolution is just one way that things change over time. And in the rescue effect, it's one of those six different processes that are involved. My expertise is not about how people are evolving or changing. So I don't think I want to wade into whether humans are undergoing evolution right now. If anything, we're probably not evolving as fast because we've done such a good job of avoiding all the ways that we used to die that would cause selection. With respect to whether or not evolution exists, I mean, as a scientist, that I don't really consider that an open question because we can measure it and we can see it happening. So there's not really much doubt that evolution happens from a scientific perspective.
Right. And so let's get into the six rescue effects, demographic rescue, reproductive, genetic, am I saying this right? Phenotype, or is it phenotype? Phenotype?
Phenotypic, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Geographic and evolutionary. So let's start here with the first one, demographic rescue. What is that exactly mean and entail?
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're getting at is, so those are all, you know, relatively technical terms that give rise to this response in nature. It's a lot to take them all on at once. And in the book, I try to weave them in and out of different chapters so that you get a little bit at a time. But you take something like demographic rescue. This just means that you've got a situation where you maybe have a very small population of some organism. And if for some reason, maybe that population is in decline. Maybe there's been a storm or a drought or a disease that's run through. Demographic rescue is when another population of the same organism somewhere else helps rescue it by just having a few individuals immigrate into that population. So a few new individuals come in, those individuals help bolster the population, and they help it persist over time. This kind of thing happens all the time in nature because most things that we think of as species are not just in one place. They're in many different places. And there's some connection between those different places where individuals will move from one to another. And in doing so, they can rescue small populations.
Got it. And reproductive rescue, let's move on to that.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way to think about this one is this is a baby boom. So what happens in a lot of populations, if you leave them to their own devices over time, they will increase to a size where they get to what's called the carrying capacity. And they tend to just sort of then hang out at that population size. But now imagine you get something that kills off a bunch of them. What you're left with is a population that's gotten much smaller. Well, in that small population, those individuals aren't so crowded. There's more food, there's more territories. They may actually do better than they did when the population size was larger. And the sign that that is happening, which you often see, is that they have lots of babies or their babies have particularly good survival. And you get this boom of in the population that starts increasing it back up to that high level it was at before.
Got it. Genetic rescue.
So genetic rescue is related to the first one. So if you've got immigration connecting populations and keeping them from going extinct, in genetic rescue, when you have new immigrants come in, those immigrants are bringing some new genetic diversity to that population. So imagine you had a population of trees that was struggling to survive in climate change, and you had a few new trees coming into that system from a place that was warmer and brought genes for surviving at higher temperatures. Those few new individuals might have a really important effect on the population as a whole, helping it to deal with environmental change.
And the phenotype or phenotype, I can't remember which one it was. Obviously not a scientist here, so.
No, it's just fine. All organisms have a phenotype, and a phenotype is your physiology, your behavior, and your appearance. And what happens in nature is that organisms are constantly adjusting their phenotype for different conditions. So to give you an example, a few years ago, I went hiking in the Himalayas in India, and I went higher in elevation than I've ever been before. And my body automatically knew to start adjusting to the higher elevation. My blood composition started changing. Certain genes got turned on. My behavior changed. I would go more slowly. I would breathe more deeply. Nobody had to tell me to do any of those things. I didn't have to push any buttons to make that happen. My body sensed the change in environment and began to respond automatically. This happens for all organisms all over the world. And it's one of the, usually it's sort of like the first line of defense. As soon as an environment begins to change, organisms begin adjusting their phenotype to deal with that change.
Got it. All right. Geographic rescue.
Okay. So yeah. Geographic rescue is moving in space. So if you imagine you've got some organism, it lives in a particular place, it likes the environmental conditions there, but over time they begin to change. Maybe it's too hot or too dry. Well, left to its own devices, that species might eventually disappear and go extinct in that place. However, if the species can disperse, maybe it's got seeds that get blown on the wind, or it can walk from one place to another, maybe it'll find new places in a different location that have conditions that work well for it. If it does that, it's undergoing what I call geographic rescue. And we're seeing this happen all over the planet right now as species are starting to respond to climate change and beginning to move to new locations. For example, in North America, some species are disappearing in the south and they're moving further north than we've seen them previously. That's geographic rescue.
And the last one, evolutionary rescue. We kind of touched on that earlier.
So that's the first one that you started with, which is that when faced with a change in the environment, organisms can evolve new capabilities. And, you know, it used to be in science, we would think of evolution as something that takes a really, really long time to happen. Right. You know, you imagine humans evolving from a monkey-like ancestor. That's something that takes place over millions of years. But evolution can actually happen instantaneously. All it requires is that something happens that causes some organisms to die, other ones to survive, and the ones that survive are genetically different from the ones that died. So the kinds of places we expect to see this now are evolution for organisms that are better at dealing with higher temperatures, or better at dealing with forest fires, or better at dealing with droughts, the kinds of things that are becoming more common as our climate is changing. That can happen fairly quickly, and we're starting to see more evidence that it's happening in nature.
Being somewhat optimistic and taking the somewhat optimistic approach or look that you're taking. Where do you stand on what we should do as individuals to continue to help the environment, man-made climate change, and what corporations do or don't do to support the environment? I mean, do we all still, do you believe that we also have a responsibility to do the little things, recycle, you know, use as few fossil fuels as possible? Or do you think everything's just going to adapt and everybody will be okay?
I think that's a great question. And the answer is no, we can't just be complacent here. The rescue effect in nature is strong, but it's not all powerful. And what happens is that as the world changes more and as it changes faster, more and more species are going to get left behind. They're going to be struggling. And so the most important thing we can do globally is actually slow down the rate of change. And climate is number one on my list, which is we have to figure out a way to begin to bend the curve of fossil fuel emissions rather than see it go up, up, up. If we don't do that, we're just going to see such rapid change in our climate that a lot of things won't make it. So if there's a number one, yeah, figure out what you can do in climate. And that's a combination of your individual choices around your own greenhouse gas footprint. And it's also related to who you vote for and what they're willing to do to try and solve climate issues, as well as what organizations you support.
I've read or heard somebody say this one time, and I don't know if it's true or not. I'm just putting it out there to you. I saw somebody say every civilian in the country, in the world, whatever, could do everything right. Right. Like, we could all drive electric vehicles. We could all recycle. We can all do all the things, all the little things we can do. But if major corporations don't change the way they operate, climate change, we're not going to have an impact on climate change. Do you find that true, false, somewhat true, anything?
So I don't know the details well enough to give you a super specific answer, but what I can tell you is that just individual choices on climate probably won't add up to enough. I agree with that statement. I think we actually need significant government and international involvement in the scale of solutions that are really going to make a difference. And so, you know, corporations are clearly involved in that. And, you know, one of the ways to deal with that is through regulation and what the government expects of corporations and what it allows them to do or not to do. The reality is that, you know, climate change is a kind of problem unlike anything we've really ever grappled with as a species, because it requires so many different things pointing in the same direction at the same time that we really need all hands on deck.
Why don't you think people take it as seriously as maybe we should?
Partly because humans are incredibly adaptable. We're really good at figuring out how to survive under many, many different kinds of conditions. And so while we can talk about, you know, big disasters as being related to climate, and those disasters do affect people, especially when and in the immediate aftermath of when they occur, so far, at least, it hasn't added up to enough general support to drive large-scale change. So it doesn't mean that people aren't doing things, doesn't mean the government isn't doing things, but I don't think anyone would argue at this point we've got this covered.
You don't think we've been scared enough to really make those changes yet?
Well, and that gets at one of, you know, sort of an important question that we need to be asking is what is actually motivating to people? And is fear the right motivator? Mm-hmm. I worry about overusing fear as a motivator in conservation overall, because I think at some point it can turn people off and some point it can demotivate people. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I think it's good that nature is good at taking care of itself, because it gives us some reason for optimism. I'm actually better motivated by feeling like I can make a difference than feeling like, you know, the world is falling apart. And so we need to figure out how to navigate this arena and find ways to motivate people to act on all of these issues.
You're the president of the United States right now. If you could sign one thing into law that would help the environment, what would that be? What would be that first big thing be for you?
Yeah. So I want to be clear, this is not my my expertise area, but listen, I think national scale significant action on climate would be pretty amazing, but that's not the president's sole discretion to make a decision like that. Right. But I think that's what we're going to need at the scale of this country. But obviously it can't stop there, because we live in on a planet with many other countries. And so I think the combination of sort of national level decisions plus international decisions are going to be required to add to all the other work people are doing regionally, locally, and individually.
All right. And if there's one piece of advice you could tell just regular people to help with conservation, with the environment, with slowing climate change, what is that?
Watch your own carbon footprint and think about who you vote for.
Yeah, The Rescue Effect is the book. Michael Meadow Webster, thank you so much for doing this. Write another book. Come back on sometime.
All right. It's been fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. You can book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience right now, starting at only $350. Cinema Anywhere Nashville provides your choice of a 16, 24, 36, or even a 100-foot screen, plus projector setup and sound system. This is a super dope service that wouldn't just be great for corporate and work events, but also birthday and holiday parties, or if you want to have a romantic evening with your significant other, Cinema Anywhere Nashville is perfect for all of those things. They have the right experience for you. Follow them on Instagram right now at Cinema Anywhere Nashville and book your cinema experience today. I want to say thank you once again to my guest, Michael Meadow Webster. Make sure you check out his book, The Rescue Effect. You can follow me on Instagram if you're not already at DolaWhite101, DOLEWITE 101. That's the same for Twitter and TikTok too, I believe. If not, it's under the Dola White Podcast. I don't check TikTok that much, but find me and follow me anyway. Brand new episodes next week. My guest is going to be Annie Duke. She wrote a book about how quitting is a good thing. So that's going to be fun to explore. Definitely stay tapped in for that. Also, no matter what platform you're currently listening on, make sure you're following, subscribing, all of those things. If they let you rate and review, say something nice about your boy, all right? Brand new episode drops next Wednesday morning. Thank you for checking out the podcast. I'm out.